I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. For a country that says it values the right to vote, we sure make it difficult to cast a ballot. From the poll taxes of years past and purging voters from rolls, which still happens to today, to voter ID laws and long lines of voters waiting hours at polling stations, it's no wonder so many people don't vote. In fact, more Americans didn't vote in 2016 than voted for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. This year, the pandemic, misinformation about voting, and an intense race for the White House has made the 2020 election even more challenging and consequential. Well, we have two experts, election experts, to guide us through the process and to answer your questions. Let me introduce them to you. Joining us by Skype is Kim Whaley. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. She's a frequent contributor to NPR's Morning Edition. Kim Whaley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Franita Tolson, and she's Vice Dean for Faculty and Academic Affairs and Professor of Law at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. And she's an election analyst for CNN. Franita Tolson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want you to join our conversation. We're sure you have lots of questions, probably lots of comments as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. So where to begin? I have a civics 101 question for both of you. And Kim, I will start with you. Does the Constitution, is there anything in the Constitution written that gives us the right to vote?
Well, the original Constitution does not. So, of course, we have many amendments to the Constitution, I think 27 total, and the right to vote is mentioned about six times in the amendments. But the original Constitution actually does not contain an affirmative right to vote. And remember, at the time the Constitution was ratified, the only people who could vote were white male landowners. So the history of voting in the United States is about opening that voting tent to more and more people, originally formerly enslaved males, then, of course, women with the 19th Amendment, and then later, you know, people under between the age of 18 and 21, et cetera. But I think it runs through problems we still have in our country, because we don't all automatically are born, you know, citizens don't automatically get on the voter rolls, unlike in other democracies.
We have to opt in. Opt into the system rather than being automatically registered.
Right. We have to sometimes, I think, prove you, that you have a right to vote, you know, and we have this debate running through kind of implicitly still when we hear about voter fraud versus voter suppression. Should the right people with the right to vote be allowed to vote? I mean, that's we're still debating whether people who legitimately have the right to vote should have easy access to the polls. And that's, of course, very different from other democracies where people are automatically registered. And actually, there could be a penalty for not voting. I'm not necessarily advocating the latter, but it is kind of silly at this point that we're still debating whether people should have access to the polls if they have that right.
Franita Tolson, let me quote something from Bush v. Gore. Of course, this is from the year 2000, and this is just a couple of words here. The Supreme Court affirmed in Bush v. Gore that, quote, the individual citizen has no federal constitutional right to vote for electors for the president of the United States. Can you speak to that? And then I do want to get to a lot of the very important specifics of voting. But just broadly speaking, how do you see our right to vote?
Yes, so I agree with Kim's points. I think that in the context of the president, Article 2 gives state legislatures the power to decide how electors are allocated. So states are free to enfranchise citizens to vote for those electors, but they can also decide to choose the electors themselves. So that's what that language in Bush versus Gore means. And I also agree that the original Constitution does not provide for an affirmative right to vote. Instead, it's a judicially created right to vote. So in the 1960s, there were a series of cases in which the Warren Court interpreted the Constitution to provide for a right to vote, but it's not directly there in the text. Instead, the constitutional text has a series of prohibitions on states and their ability to disenfranchise people. So they can't disenfranchise people on the basis of race. They have to allow people 18 or older to vote on the basis of gender and so on. So, and I do think that that creates a lot of problems in the sense of allowing states to have great leeway in disenfranchising individuals and making it more difficult to vote because it's not a positive entitlement.
Well, and just to pick up on something you just said, Fernita, and again, just as a kind of reminder to our listeners, is that the Electoral College and the electors, these are the people that pick who becomes the president of the United States. Can you speak to that briefly, Fernita?
Yes. So the Electoral College is so when people vote on November 3rd, they choose a slate of electors. So you either choose a slate of electors in support of one of the two major candidates from the two major parties, so Donald Trump or Joe Biden, or you can vote for a third party candidate.
Sure.
But then those electors convene in the states on December 14th, and they cast their votes for whoever wins the popular vote of that state. And then that slate of electors, their votes go to Congress in the beginning of January. And so essentially when people vote for president, they're not really voting for president. They're voting for a slate of electors who then meet and vote and choose the president.
Kim, let me go back to you. And picking up on what you both said, we do have a decentralized system. So you've got states and territories who essentially control what happens within their borders. How does that complicate the right to vote?
Well, as I say in the book, it basically makes the right to vote contingent on what your zip code is. So in some states, you can walk in on election day and register and vote very easily. There are five states that are almost exclusively had voting by mail for years, so you can do it from home. In other places, you have to jump through more hoops to get on the registration rolls and to stay on the rolls. There is federal law that has states sort of cleaning up their roles, and sometimes that can be done in a nefarious way. But it, in the pandemic in particular, we're just seeing so many changes at the state level that it's confusing to voters. So not only does it make it, dependent on where you live, how easy it is to register, to stay registered, to actually show up at the polls and be recognized as an eligible voter on election day. But because we have so many different systems, certainly in a pandemic, when things are changing at the last minute, it just confuses voters. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the day as well, states have stretched budgets. And if they're running these processes without sufficient federal funding, it's a lot of what happens that people perceive as, chaos or maybe even wrongdoing comes down to just administrative error and how difficult it is to run an election, period. And now we're seeing states have to run basically two elections, one in person with PPE equipment that maybe they don't have full access to, and then one by mail, which not every state is used to doing in the numbers that I think we saw over the summer with the primaries and that we'll also see in November.
Well, let me add to this, but also hopefully clear it up. President Trump has claimed that mail-in ballots cannot be trusted, that mailing in your vote cannot be trusted. And here he is speaking in North Carolina. This is just last week, September 2nd, saying that voters should send in mail-in ballots and then also vote at a polling location to make sure the mail ballot is counted. Let's give it a listen. And then I do want to play something that Bill Barr said to CNN's Wolf Blitzer, but let's start with the president.
On your ballots, if you get the unsolicited ballots, send it in and then go make sure it counted. And if it doesn't tabulate, you vote. You just vote. And then if they tabulate it very late, which they shouldn't be doing, they'll see you voted and so it won't count. So send it in early and then go and vote. And if it's not tabulated, you vote and the vote is going to count.
Same day, let me play a clip. This is CNN's Wolf Blitzer. He's asking Attorney General Bill Barr about the president's statement about people voting twice.
It sounds like he's encouraging people to break the law and try to vote twice.
Well, I don't know exactly what he was saying, but it seems to me what he's saying is he's trying to make the point that the ability to monitor this system is not good. And if it was so good, if you tried to vote a second time, you would be caught. if you voted in person.
That would be illegal if they did that. If somebody mailed in a ballot and then actually showed up to vote in person, that would be illegal.
I don't know what the law in the particular state says.
You can't vote twice.
Well, I don't know what the law in the particular state says and when that vote becomes final.
Is there any state that says you can vote twice?
Well, there's some, you know, maybe that you can change your vote up to a particular time. I don't know what the law
is.
I'm not going to offer.
He was saying test the system.
You know, well, if you know what he's saying, why are you asking me what he's saying?
He doesn't believe in the mail-in voting.
So that's a back and forth between Wolf Blitzer and Attorney General Bill Barr and Fernita Tolson. Who's correct, Wolf Blitzer or the Attorney General?
Don't vote twice.
Don't vote twice. I mean, here we are, right?
Yeah, there's no state where you can vote twice legally. And so I do think that, so there are a couple things here. It's just so much time packed. There's no evidence that there's widespread fraud with mail-in ballots, right? There are, you know, there's no voting mechanism is perfect in a sense that you can have some administrative stuff because of the volume expected. But generally speaking, there's no evidence that, you know, mail-in voting is insecure. There are a number of ways to do it depending on the state. You can, some states have drop boxes where you can drop your ballot off. You can mail it in. Some states allow you to show up and drop off your mail-in ballot at the polling precinct. But that's far different, I think, than what the president was suggesting, right? Don't vote by mail, mail it in, and then go try to vote in person. That is voting twice, and that is illegal. So I think it's very important to be clear so that you don't confuse voters in thinking that they have to do this or that it's necessary because they don't trust the system. There's no evidence that voting by mail is insecure.
Kim, can you weigh in on that?
Yeah, it's also, I mean, I'm surprised the attorney general isn't aware of the federal statute that actually makes it a crime to vote twice in the same election. And, you know, the problem here in part, and I don't want listeners to sort of be worried about their ability to vote this fall. The problem here in part is that the president's rhetoric is stoking tremendous amount of confusion and fear around voting. I think for most of us, it's a fairly straightforward process. We are now used to going to the grocery store. We're moving about in the community. We understand about, you know, wearing masks and social distancing, et cetera. So if you go physically to the polls, it's best to go early where there's not as many people. And if you want to vote by mail, as Fredina indicates, there, you know, the president, this president and President Bush both commissioned panels to investigate and sort of weed out voter fraud, right, as, you know, early on in their administrations. And those panels were disbanded because they couldn't find any. This is just flatly incorrect. And I think it's incumbent on every American in this moment, as Michelle Obama said in her speech at the Democratic National Convention, to have a vote plan because it is a pandemic. And get your mail-in ballot. If you don't want to put it in the mail, physically drop it off. As Fernita said, there will be drop-off boxes in some places. In some places, you can drop it off physically at the polls. And if that's not workable for you, you don't get your mail-in ballot in time, et cetera, then physically go to the polls. And for most of us, it'll be just fine. We even saw this over the summer in the primaries, huge voter turnout, and people did just fine. And I think part of the strategy,
you know,
here,
what I got to jump in here. I got to jump in here only because we're up on a break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about voting in 2020. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about voting, the right to vote, with all the misinformation and legal challenges coming fast and furious. It's not surprising that many people, including myself from time to time, get confused. Talking with Fernita Tolson. She is Vice Dean for Faculty and Academic Affairs, Professor of Law at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. Kim Whaley with us as well. She's a Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Wrote a book called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. And we do want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us that phone phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Kim, sorry I had to step on you there. We were up on our break. But Fernita, let me go back to you in terms of just having a plan, especially under the pandemic and all the sort of moving parts that seem to happen when it comes to voting this year. What should that plan look like?
So I think you have to take your circumstances into consideration, right? One of the upsides of the pandemic, believe it or not, everything is a downside, right? But there is one upside, right? Because it sort of highlights the different options that voters have. Because even in non-global pandemic circumstances, you can, you know, try to vote by mail, you Sure. can vote early, you can vote on Election Day. But I think culturally we are somewhat conditioned to vote on Election Day. And so this is an opportunity to figure out what works best for you. But you have to plan ahead of time, right? So check your registration, make sure you're registered to vote by the registration deadline, importantly, and then decide if you want to vote by mail. And unless you live in a state where they're automatically sending you a ballot, then you can request your ballot. Check and see if your state requires an excuse to vote absentee. There are a small number of states that still require an excuse to vote absentee by mail. Or if you want to vote in person, vote early, or have a plan for Election Day. So there are a lot of options here, and I think one of the upsides of our current circumstances is that it highlights to voters that there are a number of ways you can participate in our democracy.
Well, let me get Matt from Glenside to join our conversation. And Matt, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Go ahead, Matt. You're on the air.
Great. Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead,
Hi,
Matt.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to hear the guest's comment on AP had an article this week on the 7th where they analyzed, I think it was 7 different battleground states looking at rejection rates. And they also talked about Pennsylvania. And in Pennsylvania, according to them, 1.4% of the ballots from the primary this year were rejected because signatures didn't match, right. They didn't arrive on time or whatever. If that occurs in the upcoming election, that same rejection rate and the turnout is the same as 2016, according to the article, that's 43,000 votes that won't get counted. And I think I think they're whitewashing this a little bit. And also,
well, you know what, Matt? Yeah, let me take your point because I think it's an important one. And I saw that same article, and I think looking across the country, something like 500,000 ballots were rejected because of errors in the primary season that is almost over. But let me toss that to Kim Whaley about just the importance of filling out a ballot correctly. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons, it's a great question, one of the problems, I should say, with the fact that we have this patchwork system across the country is that the ballots don't all look consistent. And if you go to our neighbors in the north in Canada, it's the same ballot across the country with, you know, big white circles, and you put an X in it, and it's very, very clear. And unfortunately, ballots can be very confusing, and that can disenfranchise people. So Matt's absolutely right. And as you indicate, 500,000 votes were discarded. And some states, you have an opportunity to fix your error, that they will contact you if there's time. Some states there just isn't enough time, and some states you're not allowed to fix it. They'll just toss your ballot out. So unfortunately, I think we will see in November a lot of votes not necessarily be counted that should have been counted. And that's not a reason not to vote. There's two things to take away from that. One is, I think for the integrity of the electoral process in the United States, period, we need to see a massive turnout in the fall as a shot across the bow to our elected leaders across the political spectrum that this is still a democracy by we the people, and we are in charge. So staying home is not a vote for anything. It's a vote against, frankly, in my mind, a free and fair electoral process. And number two is just to read the directions really, really, really carefully. You know, some votes were discarded ballots because somebody didn't check a tiny box. I know in some states they're, you know, adding different colors to draw people's attention to those little details. But the said the best information you can get is really on your Secretary of State's website for your state, because in most states, that's the entity that controls how the electoral process works out. And as Fernita indicates, get on your website today. Make sure you're registered. You might have to ask for your ballot again by mail, even if you ask for it in the primaries. That's the case in Maryland. And when it comes, read it over with a fine-tooth comb. And if you're concerned about mail-in and you're comfortable with your health, physically going to the polls is more likely to result in not having your ballot rejected for sort of, you know, not crossing the right T on the mail-in ballot form.
Fernita, this is a related comment, one from Drexel Hill from Harold, who says, I just got a notice in the mail that the last day to request a ballot in Pennsylvania is October 27th. That's absurd to cut it so close. Why are they making it so tight? He goes on to say, my dog could design a better system. And obviously, we're talking about Pennsylvania, but different states have different deadlines. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think I might agree. That is
that his dog could do a better job.
That's cutting it really, really close. And I think in normal election years, that's usually fine.
Right.
But to be fair to the election administrators, they're trying to figure out a way to give voters room. And part of this will be incumbent upon the voters to make things easier for them. So even though the deadline is October 27th, request it early. Right, because a lot of this is about bending the absentee ballot request curve, right? It's about making sure that we are doing what we need to do so that our vote will count and that the election officials have time to receive it. Because keep in mind that with the issues with the post office and stuff, it's uncertain about, you know, whether, you know, how much time it will take for the ballots to get to where they need to go. So I think that voters just have to be more aggressive this year about making sure that they have a plan, but also two, that they take steps to execute that plan early.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Fernita Tolson, and she's a professor of law at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. Also with us, Kim Whaley. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. And she's got a new book, What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. And frankly, that is what we're talking about today in Radio Times. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us. That number is 1-888-477-9499. Kim, let me go back to you and something that you write in your book, and I mentioned it in my introduction, that in 2016, 39% of eligible voters did not vote. This would be for president, and that's more than voted for either Trump or Clinton. And I guess, and just to add to that, half of eligible voters under 35 also did not vote in 2016. What is the reason for that extraordinarily high non-participation rate?
Well, the Knight Foundation just did a study on that very question at the beginning of this year, prior to the pandemic. And surprisingly, perhaps, the number one reason why people don't vote has to do with apathy and sort of the belief that their vote doesn't matter or that they don't like the candidates or that the system is rigged. Of course, there are, you know, barriers to voting that that have been, I think, surged back since the United States Supreme Court effectively gutted the Voting Rights Act, which was designed, passed in the 1960s to make sure that states can't impose arbitrary barriers to keep primarily people of color from coming to the polls. But we don't have a culture in this country of voting, unfortunately, as kind of like, you know, getting your vaccines for your kids or having your cup of coffee in the morning, or, you know, there are things that we do culturally. And I think we need to see a shift in that regard. I think there are two things bearing on that. One is this notion that if I stay home, that's somehow a vote, but that's not a vote for anything. You're basically allowing others to dictate the future of you know, your own community's government as well as the national government. And the second is this idea that we have to have a perfect candidate. If it's not the perfect candidate, I'm not going to vote. And that is not consistent, I think, with the spirit of democracy itself in the United States, which is about compromise. And that's how we have relationships in our regular lives. It's compromise. It's give and take. And that, I think, sentiment has been lost in our recently in our culture when we're so polarized. So the message really is, let's move those numbers up and you know, create a culture in America where voting is just something you do and something that we celebrate as a privilege of American citizenship.
Fernita, I want to give you a chance to respond to this particular part of the conversation, but let me get Phil from Pottstown to join us, and then I'll give you a chance to respond to his comments. And Phil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there, Phil. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm a young person. I'm 24. And me and a majority of my friends are very unmotivated to go out and vote for who we feel are politicians who have been not addressing the concerns of young people and have been actively working for older generations. So my question is to your guests, what can you say to motivate us to get out and vote when we feel like we've been constantly pushed down?
Phil, let me ask you, give us one issue that you, as you're representing all young people in America today, give us one issue that you feel as if the candidates, the parties are ignoring.
The main one for me, well, I have two main ones. I'm mainly concerned about healthcare because our healthcare is really problematic and riddled with issues, and it's ridiculously expensive and other things. But my biggest concern is climate change, because in 50 years, when the planet isn't livable, what are we going to do for all the people who are 24 now or the people who are having children now?
Sure. Those are two big ones and two very important ones, Phil. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Fernita, just picking up on what Phil said, what do you say back to him about voting?
Well, Phil, I completely understand. You know, when you feel like you've been ignored, you feel like you don't have any motivation to vote. But when you don't vote, you give elected officials an incentive to ignore you. That's not going to get your policies that you care about and issues that are important to you on their radar. The reason that they sort of tailored their message to older people is because older people vote at higher rates than younger people. So voting is a way to sort of exercise political power and exercise authority over elected officials so that they are responsive to your needs. When you don't vote, they have an incentive to ignore you because there's no penalty for ignoring you because you don't vote.
Kim, let me give you a chance to respond as well. And I remember being Phil's age. This was many decades ago. But for me, I remember thinking, well, it's Tweedledum or Tweedledee. This was like the 60s and the 70s and even into the 80s. Is that still true today?
Yeah, you know, I've spoken to a lot of audiences that are you know, comprised of people in Phil's, you know, demographic, age demographic, and of course teaching. And I have two responses to that. One is that, you know, having thought about not just voting, but the Constitution now as a scholar since 2006, I'm completely convinced that everything that matters to you comes down to the ballot box. Climate change, LGBTQ rights, Black Lives Matter. I mean, whatever your issue is, the way to make change in a democracy is at the ballot box. I mean, remember, you know, district attorneys are on the ballot. Judges in some places are on the ballot. You know, police sheriffs are on the ballot. And so it really is a cop out, frankly. And I understand. And I've had this conversation with my kids' friends as well. That's number one. There's really no way to make the change in a democracy when you stay home. Staying home will definitely do nothing. Number two is, and this I think resonates with young people, is to pay attention to the privilege of democracy in America, because there are a lot of people on the planet who don't have the ability to go to the polls and choose their leaders. It's either a fake democracy or they literally are, you know, in fear of their own safety if they exercise the political franchise. So I think respecting the privilege of American democracy and the people that have frankly fought and died for the right to vote since the founding and certainly during the civil rights era, it's respecting that privilege. Number two is, I think, really, really important. And then the third piece, and I've had this conversation with students, this belief that, you know, it has to be someone that speaks specifically to you or nobody at all. I think older people understand perhaps that, you know, compromise is how change is made. It's made carefully and methodically, you know, bit by bit, not in one fell swoop. And I think that does require young people to come out in huge numbers and tell the older generation that they need to be heard, as Fernita indicates. I completely agree with that.
Fernita, let me read a comment from Dave, who says this show is necessary because voting has become so complicated. We used to all come together to vote in person and have a winner on election day. Now there are too many options, too long a voting period, too much confusion. We have sacrificed confidence for convenience. That's an interesting comment. What do you think about that?
So, and confidence for convenience. I really like that. That's hard for me. Yes and no, right? So, in some ways, if voting is truly a right, then it should be easy to cast a ballot. It should be convenient. But I do think it's also important that people have confidence in the system. But I'm not convinced that the convenience has caused the crisis of confidence, right? A lot of this is about rhetoric. Right, our language around voting, particularly in the last decade or so, has been about emphasizing how fraudulent the system is, despite evidence to the contrary, as opposed to emphasizing the fact that the right to vote is fundamental. Right, and this really ties in with our earlier conversation about how important it is for people to come out and make their policy preferences known, despite this rhetoric. Right, because I don't necessarily see those two things, confidence and convenience, as necessarily incompatible. It can be convenient to vote, and we can do so in a way where we still maintain confidence in the system, but we have to be careful about our rhetoric. Marty, can I make one other point?
Sure,
about
please, go ahead.
Topic?
Yep.
So Kim's comments, which I agree with completely, brought something to mind in light of everything that's going on with the protests and Black Lives Matter and how young people are taken to the streets. I do think some young people see it as an either-or proposition, like, you know, either you get out and protest or you vote. They see protesting as a type of political participation that could replace voting. And I do think it's important to encourage them not to see it that way, that they're really complements, that you can get out, you can protest, you can make your voices heard, and then you can turn out at the ballot box in November to validate those preferences. So I think that if young people start to see it as more of a partnership, as a way of, let's just say, a finish on their earlier political activism, then they won't have such apathy about voting.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Fernita Tolson. And again, she is Vice Dean for Faculty and Academic Affairs and Professor of Law at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. And she is also an election analyst for CNN. Kim Whaley with us as well. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She's got a new book, What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. And she does commentary from time to time on NPR's Morning Edition. We want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with our guests, Fernita Tolson and Kim Whaley, about voting. Let me play one more clip, and this is Representative Jim Cooper asking U.S. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. This is at a House Oversight and Reform Committee hearing, which took place on August 24th. It was about slowdowns at the Postal Service. This question was about allegations or questions about violating campaign finance laws by pressuring employees at his company to make campaign donations to Republicans that he would later reimburse. Let's give it a listen.
Did you pay back several of your top executives for contributing to Trump's campaign by bonusing or rewarding them?
That's an outrageous claim, sir, and I resent it.
I'm just asking a question.
The answer is no.
So you did not bonus or reward any of your executives?
No.
Or anyone that you solicited for a contribution to the Trump campaign?
No, sir.
Not in whole or in part?
During the Trump campaign, I wasn't even working at my company anymore.
Let me quote something from the Washington Post. This is from David Young. This was DeJoy's former director of human resources, and he told the Washington Post, quote, Lewis was a national fundraiser for the Republican Party. He asked employees for money. We gave them the money, and he reciprocated by giving us big bonuses. Kim Whaley, let me go back to you. Is that illegal?
Well, soliciting campaign donations, yes, that way. I'll actually let Fernita weigh in more specifically on that. But I think the important thing to keep in mind here has to do with the president's choice of someone in the Postal Service in the midst of a pandemic when he has a history of saying that the Postal Service itself is a joke and that he has indicated he doesn't want to see the money go to the Postal Service that's necessary to bail out the Postal Service. And unfortunately, in this moment, this does create an environment where, again, we have people worrying about their ability to cast their ballots in a legitimate way that is going to be counted. Mr. DeJoy told Congress that these delays are going to be fixed, but that he doesn't need additional money. It just is, again, another chink in the sort of system that destabilizes the election in the fall and gets, I think, creates an incentive for Americans, as we both said, to put their plan together to make sure that their vote is heard.
Fernita, picking up on what we just listened to, is it legal to pressure an employee to make a donation to a political candidate or party and then get reimbursed?
It's very illegal.
Okay. Not just illegal, but very illegal. Okay.
It's a way of evading campaign finance limits, and so it's illegal. But I just want to sort of echo Kim's point about what his appointment to Postmaster General, that position says about let me put it this way. It does not bode well for our system more generally, because not only is it about the election in November, it's about individuals not receiving their medicine by mail, not receiving important packages. This is a true breakdown in the system. It just so happens that it also has significant implications for November, but it should not be, don't overlook the fact that this is just bad generally. But this is why it is important to, one, have a plan, but also to understand that if you don't have comfort about your ballot arriving in time, there are other options available to you. Just check the Secretary of State website for the state that you live in and figure out what your options are. So it's not that the answer to this is not to say I'm not going to vote. The answer to this instead is to say, well, how can I vote and make sure that my ballot gets to where it needs to get to in time?
Marty, can I add something to
that?
Yeah,
go ahead, Kim.
Which is we have a lot of discussion nationally about what's legal and what's illegal, and it's conceivable Mr. DeJoy would be subject to some kind of legal jeopardy by virtue of that. But at the end of the day, whether something's illegal is less important than whether illegalities bring consequences. And so in this moment, we are just not seeing a lot of sort of potential illegalities or norm breaking happening at the federal level having any consequence. The Justice Department is not going to bring any cases involving people close to Donald Trump, given that Mr. Barr has made very clear where his loyalties lie. Congress is not taking the steps necessary to hold the executive branch accountable, notwithstanding its prerogative and obligation under the United States Constitution and the various levers of oversight it has. And I raise this because this is why, as I indicated earlier, the vote is so important, because at the end of the day, it really is what's left in America in this moment to hold our elected officials accountable, because the traditional separation of powers is just not functioning. I mean, if we have we all know if you drive down the street and there's a 35 mile per hour speed limit, but there's no tickets for speeding on that street, people will go 50. But if there is a speed camera hiding in the bushes, people slow down and go 35. And right now, there is no speed camera for the Trump administration except for the ballot box. And so back to Phil's point, that I would just believe in this fall, it's so important to vote for democracy itself, to protect the institution of an accountable government for our children who can't vote and future generations.
Let me read another comment. And Fernita, I'll give you a chance. So this is an email from John, and he raises questions about a couple of states having trouble coming up with the results of their primaries. They came up with results, but it took days, if not even weeks. And I think there's a question, not to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but question raised that on November 3rd, on election day or night, when we normally expect to get results then, because of the way our voting system is set up, chances are we're not going to know on the night of the election who won the White House or not. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. It's possible, and that's fine, right? We have to moderate our expectations. Under normal circumstances, we do know who the winner is election night. But even if we don't know, that doesn't mean that there's some type of, nefarious behavior happening during the counting, nor should it cast doubts on the legitimacy of the election. There will be an unprecedented number of voters voting by mail this fall. And so it's really important to give the states time to count the votes and also to make sure that they have counted properly. In some states, they can't even start counting until election night.
And that's true in Pennsylvania, actually.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just really important not to infer any bad intent or malpractice just by virtue of the fact that we don't know who the winner is election night. It might even be better to think about it as election week or election month. Okay. Any way that helps us to moderate our expectations about expecting to know who the winner is.
Kim, let me ask you about something, and I've heard people say this, and the president has sort of intimated but not said it directly, but he's sort of questioning the results of the election already. Nonetheless, let's say he loses but refuses to accept the results of the election and refuses, frankly, to step down. How does our system work?
Well, that would be an unprecedented situation, but I have thought about this. I think, 9 months ago or 6 months ago, people thought it was impossible, but I don't think it's beyond the pale in this moment. Under the United States Constitution, January 20th, he ceases to be president as a matter of law. He will no longer be president. So that is the deadline. But as Fernita indicates, the ballot counting is an issue.
Right.
It could go into December. It could go into January. And there's some confusion around what happens if there's a contested election. The House of Representatives, bottom line, would decide the presidency. The Senate would decide potentially the vice presidency. If there is not a president on January 20th, it would be Nancy Pelosi under a statute known as the Succession Act. She would be the interim president. But I think the bigger question really is if we have sort of the kind of just uprising and potential violence around some of these issues that the president, frankly, has stoked recently on Black Lives Matter and other questions. And in that moment, it will come down in part, I think, to public servants doing the right thing on behalf of the American people to keep the peace and to allow the system to unfold. And we just have to hope that that's what will happen. If the system is allowed to unfold as a legal, methodical, careful, thoughtful way, we will all be fine. If people try to throw monkey wrenches into it and get the bases on either side upset, then I do think there's a problem. The president doesn't have the power to call in the military, for example, and there is not enough federal law enforcement, I think, across the country to basically address this en masse. And in this moment, the military and study polls show they don't support this kind of a sort of authoritarian leaning government. So we're just going to have to see, Marty. Unfortunately, I think for now, everyone needs to take a deep breath and just get their vote counted.
Fernita, do you want to weigh in on this? I mean, what Kim is talking about is, I mean, we do have a system. We have a system of checks and balances. We have a system of the transfer of power. And the question is, will it hold? Do you have confidence?
I'm less worried about the formal system in a sense. There's no legal effect of a concession, right? If he doesn't concede, Kim is right. January 20th, he ceases to become president. I mean, ceases to be president anymore. I'm more worried about the effect of, so he refuses to concede, and then what do his supporters do? That's what I'm worried about, right? Does it turn into a potentially violent situation? Do their refusal to accept the election results, could that lead to some type of uprising? I have more concern on that front, and I think that's why the concession becomes important, even though it doesn't have any legal significance.
So on January 20th, the Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts will swear in somebody, correct? Can we just, you know, and hopefully it would be the person who wins the election. Kim?
Yeah. Oh, for me. This I think comes as a surprise to a lot of people. The Constitution doesn't answer a lot of these questions. It just does not. And a lot of how our system of government stays functioning has to do with respecting norms and traditions and, you know, ceding power, you know, peacefully. You know, Al Gore did it famously in the Bush versus Gore election in 2000. You know, presidents turn over their tax returns or candidates not because the law even requires it or they'll go to jail if they won't. It's because they respect the system and the traditions, and they don't want trauma on the nation. And this president is just not that way. And I think the good news, frankly, is the next, you know, if we do see a different kind of president, the more, you know, the traditional kind of president that respects the office of the presidency, we could see real reforms like we saw post-Watergate, legislative reforms to clarify some of these ambiguities so that if again we're in an environment where there's someone basically smashing all the glass in the house the way this president is, there are established laws in place and procedures in place to address it. But in this moment, it's a bit of the Wild West, and I agree with Fernita. I'm particularly concerned with, you know, the president's use of federal law enforcement without identifying insignia in connection with the Lafayette Square protests, et cetera, and copycat vigilantes that are well armed, kind of coming to these moments, you know, the polls and afterwards. He's indicated he wants poll watchers, et cetera. That's my concern. And then the question is, who's going to tamp that down? We have a federalist system. So we do have states that have their own law enforcement officials. And again, I just think in this moment, Americans need to come together around core values of integrity, core values around who we are as people, that it's we the people, not we the Republicans, not we the Democrats, we the people. And if democracy itself fails, everyone goes down with it. It's not a political moment anymore. And I think that our better angels will carry us through. But it's a bit precarious right now. I'm not gonna be lie about that.
Well, and I hate to toss this in because we could do and have done whole hours about the Electoral College, but let me just pick up on a comment from Kate. She says, get rid of the Electoral College. And Fernita, I'm watching the clock here. We just got a couple of minutes before we have to end our conversation. But, okay. I mean, there are certainly instances where the person who becomes president did not get the popular vote. That would be Bush, and that would also be Trump. Would getting rid of the Electoral College, would that help in any way deal with what we've been talking about?
I think it'll make us feel better. Just in a sense of,
okay.
I mean, the Electoral College is a relic from an earlier time, right? It was a compromise between slave owners and everyone else in order to protect what was essentially a political minority. It feels weird to be governed by a system like that. And so I do think that people feel some sort of way when a person wins the Electoral College but loses the popular vote, right? Because so much of our story, particularly in the last 50 or 60 years, has been a steady march towards democracy. Mm-hmm. And so it feels very anti-democratic when that happens. So I do think getting rid of the Electoral College is a way of trying to get around that. That feeling, right? Because it doesn't seem to line up with the core values of who we are as Americans now. But to get to a broader point about, you know, overall concerns about the election and where we are, people have to stop assuming that America is inevitable. And I think that is the problem with a lot of what's going on. People who don't vote, they assume that when they wake up on November 4th, we'll have an election outcome and we'll know and we'll move forward. Maybe, maybe not. Right. We are a aging democracy, and democracies have fallen in the past. we're also a very young country. And so it seems very weird for our posture to be that no matter what happens, America will endure. Maybe, maybe not. Because in the last 3.5 years, what we've witnessed is an unprecedented erosion of our institutions and our values. So to some extent, the inevitability of America is not a thing. And so as long as people believe that, though, I think it does sort of lend to the apathy, the refusal to turn out to vote, the refusal to stand up for things that people care about because they assume that we will just survive it. But survival is not guaranteed. Well, so I can't emphasize how important it is to vote.
Well, we have to leave it there. We're going to have the two of you back again to talk more about voting. That's Fernita Tolson. Fernita, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And Kim Whaley, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
Great conversation indeed. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.